Jeff Clark.
Okay, thank you for the introduction. So can everyone hear me and see the slides okay?
Oh, there is something wrong with the slides.
Yeah, slides are tiny.
Oh, interesting. Okay, 1 second. I think I have to move it to my other monitor. Okay. Okay, that should be better.
Oh,
okay, great. All right. So again, thank you for the introduction. Let's get started. So here's a quick introduction to the satisfiability problem. So here's an example of a very tiny SAT instance. It has 48 clauses and 3 variables per clause. And so I borrowed this slide from Orion, actually, who uses it at the start of a lot of his talks in order to stun the audience. So can we assign the variables to true and false such that all the clauses are satisfied, right? And so for example, if you look at this first clause, you could say, well, so I could assign X5 to be true, right? And that would satisfy this clause. And that would satisfy, you know, maybe, so this clause down here also. But since the second clause has not X5, then that means that we can no longer satisfy that literal. And so the second clause forces us to choose between assigning X1 or X6 false. And so you can see why it might take a human at least a few minutes to solve a problem like this. But modern SAT solvers, well, in fact, you know, even SAT solvers from like 40 years ago could solve this in like a fraction of a second. And so that's the kind of world that we're entering, this highly engineered, very fast solver world. So some more about SAT. It's the prototypical MP complete problem. Modern SAT solvers are highly engineered. They're capable of handling problems with millions of variables and clauses. They're dominated by the conflict-driven clause learning paradigm. So they're centered around a backtracking tree search through the space of assignments. But they also do a bit of analysis whenever they hit a failed assignment to analyze the source of the conflict and learn a clause that is then added to the formula and prunes the search space and thereby accelerates the execution of the backtracking tree search. And perhaps importantly, when they branch and they choose variables for that tree search, the heuristics they rely on are extremely cheap. They tend to be, they tend to be constant time. And this is one of the reasons why SAT solvers are so efficient and so scalable, because their heuristics are so fast that they can make tens of thousands of assignments a second. And so obviously, to people who like to use deep learning as a tool, who have a hammer and are trying to find something to hit, these heuristics are an appealing target for using machine learning, for example, neural networks, right? So I mean, they're appealing targets, and there's a simple way of formulating how you would apply them, right? You find some way of embedding your formula F, you know, you encode the text of the formula, or you use a graph neural network. And then you have some way of obtaining embeddings for each of the variables, and you get logits by applying an MLP. You softmax sample the next variable, and then you assign, propagate, and you repeat, right? And then you can even view this as a reinforcement learning problem, right? You just push a button and it somehow learns. There's a simple formulation of this as a finite MDP with a binary signal at the end. However, note that if you do this, the reward is sparse. So you do have to be careful with how you learn. You might have to shape the reward somehow. But there's an important problem that faces trying to use this formulation for SAT solving, namely that in practice, right, SAT solvers routinely operate at these astronomical problem scales, Right? They routinely operate on problems with tens of millions of clauses and millions of variables. And so, I mean, even at the bottom end of this astronomical scale, right, if your problems only have 1 million clauses, say, then querying a neural network for every branching variable would be suicidal. I mean, you're simply never going to get anything done because there are exponential worst time bounds on DPLL, and you're going to be waiting until, I don't know, like 100 years or something, just waiting for your GPU to finish multiplying matrices. And so given this practical problem, a solution, well, in fact, something that you're forced to do is to query less frequently, right? So, because you can't query for every choice, so you query less frequently, but to make sure that some signal from your network is coming through, you make your network's actions more impactful, right? So instead of simply assigning a variable and hoping that it somehow influences the clause that you learn from the conflict, you find a way to make your networks, to make the queries to your network more impactful and persist across multiple backtracks in the search, and to influence where the solver is in the search space. So that's the basic idea behind the approaches that I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk. So the first approach is that of cube and conquer. So the basic idea behind this is that the early choices that you make during the search are especially important, right? So naively formulated, if you don't restart, right, the first variable you select is kind of the one that you're stuck with, right? So, I mean, you are saying, I promise that I'm going to show that this branch is unsat and that branch is unsat, if you're trying to prove unsat, say. So in fact, so within the last, I would say, 10 or 20 years or so, CDCL solvers have developed very intricate restarts strategies. And recently it's been found that the purpose of these restarts is to compactify the assignment stack, i.e. to remove those bad early choices from the assignments so they no longer influence the learned clauses, clause learning. And so the early choices are important, and you want to make really, really good ones. And so the idea behind cube and conquer is you use an expensive globally informed strategy, i.e. a cuber, to make those early choices. And so what you do is, so instead of just running the search algorithm outright, you grow a partial search tree using your cuber, right? And once you've grown this partial search tree, take the search tree, you expand it a little bit, okay, and you look at a leaf and you say, okay, I think it's probably going to be easy enough by these proxy metrics. Then you freeze the search, and then you keep growing the search tree elsewhere. And then you use normal SAT solvers to finish those leaves, either in parallel or in sequence. So the cuber has typically been a look-ahead solver. So that means that the globally informed heuristic has access to a perfect model of the problem, namely the solver, right? So it can make assignments, it can, you know, look around, calculate proxy metrics, and then it can backtrack and try all the other variables in the problem. So Marijn Hull, who's at CMU, has used this to great effect on lots of hard, unsatisfiable instances, like the Pythagorean triples problem, or sure number five. So the idea behind neural cube and conquer is, well, we replace the cuber with a neural network, right? And crap, my video froze. Is my video still working?
It's working. Now the slides are a little bit shrunk again, but it's not readable, but...
Oh, sorry. Okay, so is it working now?
Well, now it's completely not working.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
I mean, you're not sharing a screen now.
Yes, one second. Okay.
Good.
Looks good.
All right, you guys can see the slides again. Okay. Yeah, I think my video just stopped working, but the talk will proceed. Okay, so so note that in this formulation, we're not using something model-based, right? We're not learning to simulate the dynamics of, you know, assigning a variable and propagating it. So instead, we're going to compute some representation of the formula once, and then use a policy gradient type thing to choose what the next variable is, or should be. Okay, so the source of training signal is going to be from DRAP proofs. We're going to use supervised learning. So the job of the cuber is to minimize solver runtime at the leaves, right? So you want to pick good parts of the search space that the conqueror solvers will be able to solve more quickly. And so you can think of SAT solvers as being these resolution proof engines, right? In fact, it's been shown that solver runtime is correlated with the size of the resolution proof of the problem that they're solving. And so if you want to select variables which minimize the expected, so we want to select variables which minimize the expected size of the resolution proofs for either branch. So I mean, the full resolution proofs are humongous, but you can, so you can represent them very compactly in the DRAT format as a sequence of learned clauses. So their Kolmogorov complexity is a lot lower than would first appear. So the idea is that you prioritize variables that occur frequently in DRAT proofs. Now, from a practical standpoint, choosing these variables leads to parts of the search space where conflicts, which you know from looking at the proof will be useful for proving unsat, will occur more often, right? So if you look at the proof instead, right, if a variable shows up a lot in the full proof tree, right, then that means that it participates in propagations, which are responsible for a lot of the size of the proof tree, right? And so that means that if you, so if you take that unit clause in the resolution proof tree and move it closer down towards the root, then that means that a lot of those propagations will no longer appear in the resolution proof tree, which then shrinks the size of the proof. So you want to choose those variables that show up frequently in proofs of unsat. Okay, so here's some deep learning engineering. So for these experiments, we use the NeuroCore architecture, which is a simplified version of the NeuroSAT graph neural network. I won't go into the details, but it's been fairly well studied. We do 4 rounds of message passing on the bipartite graph of clauses and literals. And so interestingly, we train on synthetic random problems only, right? So, so there's a class of problems called SR, which was used to train the original NeuroSAT. So you incrementally sample clauses of varying length until the problem becomes unsat, right? So if it was sat, and then unsat, then this means that a single literal in the final clause can be flipped to make the problem sat. So we elaborate this a bit further. So there's also a class of problems called SRC. So here N is the number of variables, and C is an unsatisfiable problem that can be made sat by flipping a single literal. So how you sample a problem in SRC is you make C sat, and then you sample clauses just as with SR. So you keep adding more random clauses, right, until the problem becomes unsat, right? So now you flip the literal at the end, making the problem sat again, but now you flip something inside C that makes it unsat. So that guarantees that you can plant an unsat core of a certain size. And so to generate problems for training data, we sampled 250,000 problems from SRC 100 of SR20. So that means we first sampled an unsatisfiable problem from SR20 and then planted that as an unsat core inside a larger random problem. So this ensures that like there's something to predict for an unsat core. And this will probably ensure that in the DRAP proof, the variables will be concentrated in the planted unsat core. Okay. So a data point in our training set is a pair GC, where G is a sparse clause literal adjacency matrix, and C is a vector of occurrence counts for the variable indices. And so we minimize the KL divergence between the true probabilities, the softmax of the occurrence counts, with the probabilities predicted by the network. And I kind of lied in the first bullet point. We also simultaneously trained heads for predicting whether clauses and variables occur in the UNSAT core for the sake of being able to compare DRAP proofs to UNSAT cores. Okay. And so how did we evaluate this scheme? So we pick problems which are squarely in the domain of cube and conquer, namely these really hard unsatisfiable instances. So as a measure against noise, we generate a bunch of subproblems and we average the results across them. So for example, we take Ramsey 4418 and then we randomly assign five variables inside the problem, and that creates 1,000 easier subproblems, which, you know, makes it easier for me to run these evaluations on my home computer. Similarly for Schur and van der Waarden. So I mean, you don't have to know what these problems are. You just have to know that that one, they're relatively small, and two, they're really hard. So Ramsey 4418 is not that hard, but it's kind of out of the reach of like modern CDCL solvers, unless if you have special flags or like your marine. So here's the evaluation scheme. All right, so in order to keep things simple, so we only query the network once on the entire problem. And then we select the argmax variable, the one that our network thinks most highly of, and we split on that. That produces two cubes. And our primary metric is the average solver runtime on the cubes. And so as a baseline, we compare against an implementation of Z3 of March Q, which is sort of the state of the art in Cube and Conquer. It's a it's a look ahead solver written by Marine that was then modified for cubing. It was implemented in Z3. And this performs look ahead with crazy handcrafted features. Not crazy, but they're very handcrafted. So here are the results. So the summary is that the averaged wall clock runtime in seconds tends to be lower for the variables chosen by our models. Right? So they consistently choose better branching variables than March Q with lower average runtime on the cubes across. So if you average across all 1,000 problems and all three data sets. Right? So the takeaways are, the NeuroCubers are better at branching. Well, at least they're better at picking the first variable, such that they minimize the runtime at the leaves. And DRAP proofs tend to give better signal than UNSAT cores for training heuristics for picking variables, right? So you can see that that on two out of the three, the DRAT heads of the models made better choices than the UNSAT core heads of the models. So while DRAP proofs are great, right, they're sort of the gold standard. They tell you exactly what variables are actually needed for proving UNSAT. There are lots of reasons why they're not practical, right? So I mean, the first one is that it's hard to prove UNSAT, right, because of these exponential lower bounds on DPLL. And so this means that if you commit to using DRAP proofs, right, you're saying, well, if I want to learn how to solve an NP-complete problem, I have to go solve 250,000 NP-complete problems, which is maybe not great, right? And even worse, verifying a DRAP proof and shrinking it so that you have a better idea of the exact clauses that you need for proving UNSAT, right? So that's something you have to do, because otherwise your signal will be more noisy. So verifying and running a DRAP proof checker can take even longer than running the solver that made that proof. Right. And so if you take 20 minutes to produce a single proof of UNSAT and another 20 minutes to check that proof of UNSAT, then that's kind of an unreasonably long time to wait for a single point in your training set. And finally, so if you do supervised learning with DRAP proofs, right, this limits your data, right? DRAP proofs will only label unsatisfiable problems, and it furthermore biases your data set towards problems which are easy enough for you to actually solve, right? But when you deploy your model and you're running it, you're probably not going to run into problems which were easy enough for you to include in your training pipeline. And training this way won't scale because you're always going to be waiting to create more data points, but it's really hard to create these new data points. And so we have to move beyond DRAP. And the way to do this is to take a page from SAT solving itself, right? We want to prioritize variables that optimize clause learning, right? Because clause learning is how SAT solvers work to accelerate their own search. So if we can't learn good clauses, then the solver is just going to falter and it's not going to be able to finish. So here's some theoretical basis for why we might want to focus on learning good clauses. So in really hard combinatorial problems, so there are symmetries that that cause variables to show up all over the place in DRAP proofs of unsat, right? So I mean, for example, in the Ramsey problems, you can color the graph, but you can permute the variables and you can have another coloring of the graph, right? And this means that there's less of a sharp preference for certain variables in DRAP proofs. So in this case, it's better to treat the SAT solver as something which is forward chaining for proof search, right? So if you accelerate clause learning, you might be able to find a path to the empty clause sooner. Furthermore, it's well known that SAT solvers don't really create sophisticated proofs, right? So I mean, what they do is they learn lots of short, useful lemmas from conflict analysis, and then they chain these together at the end in a massive proof. And so what you want to do is you want to focus on learning those lemmas sooner. And the useful thing about this is that now you're not limited to labeling just the unsatisfiable problems, which are easy enough for you to solve. You can label the satisfiable instances also. Okay, so you can actually formulate a path through the DPLL tree in terms of a two-player zero-sum game. So in each round, player one picks a variable, player two assigns it a value, and it propagates. Right, so the terminal value is 1/ the total number of rounds. Right, so since the game is zero sum, player one wants to minimize this quantity, and player two wants to maximize that quantity. So Alistair Urquhart showed that winning strategies for player one correspond to short proofs of unsat. And so in this way, we can see that the conflict efficiency of how we're choosing our branching variables is linked to the size of the proof and therefore the runtime of the solver. So in fact, so we can empirically validate this with the previous models that we trained, right? So we take our branching heuristics and we plug them in as the policy for player one, and then to approximate all possible strategies for player two, we use a uniform random one for player two, right? So that means our networks choose a variable and then we randomly assign it. This samples a path through the DPLL search tree. And for all 1,000 problems in the Ramsey problems, we generate 50 playouts of the game and we average the terminal values. And so the takeaways from this is that that our models are also more conflict efficient, as one would expect from from the theory that I mentioned back here. So So interestingly, they don't propagate as much, right? So March Q has these finely tuned look ahead formulas for, you know, checking the total number of propagations that would be triggered, the total number of binary clauses that show up. And so it optimizes a bit more heavily for ensuring that the variables that it chooses will propagate. Now, our models, which were trained on DRAP proofs, don't prioritize this as much, but they are still more conflict efficient. Right. So remember that here the terminal values, so here the lower the better. So we can see that the DRAT head trained on the SRC problems obtained the best score. Okay. So we can elaborate this further. Right. So instead of taking this really simple signal from the end, namely the number of steps it took to hit conflict, so we can take a well-studied proxy metric for the quality of a learned clause. So the glue level of a clause is the number of assignments which are involved in all of the members of the clause. And it has been shown that clauses with low glue level tend to propagate more frequently, and this accelerates clause learning. And in fact, the solver glucose, which introduced the concept of glue level, is centered around this concept. And when glucose first showed up, it pushed the state of the art in SAT solving by a very wide margin. And so we can modify this two-player game that I mentioned earlier so that the terminal signal is now 1 over g squared, where g is the glue level of the clause that would be learned through conflict analysis. And so we can view this as a reinforcement learning task and a finite episodic MVP and apply policy gradient methods. And this allows us to ignore the sparse terminal reward signal and view every path through the DPL tree as a separate episode. Right. So this means we can get a lot more data because we're not focusing just on, you know, whether or not we can actually get a proof of unsat at the end. We just want to learn useful lemmas that might be useful for accelerating the solver. And so the final thing which I'm going to say is that it works, and it works at scale. So I won't go into the details of this paper, but there's an advertisement for it. So we can use both the reinforcement learning formulation and a formulation in terms of supervised learning, wherein we predict variables which show up frequently in learned clauses of really small glue level called glue clauses. And we furthermore shift away from the neurosat-like architecture to a really small, really lightweight network architecture from the reinforcement learning for QBF paper. So remember to go see Marcus's talk. It's a really great paper. And this network is small enough that it allows us to use CPU-only inference, whereas previous work from NeuroCore, where they did, so they did the same thing where they periodically refocused SAT solvers. They had to use GPUs for inference, whereas here we can only use CPUs. So we target Catacol, which is a state-of-the-art CDCL solver, using periodic refocusing of the EVSID scores, which are an activity score-based way of choosing variables. And we demonstrate improvements on really hard SATCOMP benchmarks, as well as a data set of SHA-1 preimage attacks. And finally, I'm going to mention that this work was done under the supervision of John Harrison during an internship at the Automated Reasoning Group at AWS. Okay. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you. So I don't see any questions in the audience. Do we have any questions here presentially?
Let's do
what
I just
seen
somebody's.
Yeah. All right, so Vlad has raised. So Vlad, please feel free to ask your question.
Yeah, great talk, Jesse. My question is about the data you trained on. So you're training on, it looks like, very different data than what you're testing on. Have you tried playing around at all? This training distribution, maybe, like, what if you test and train on the same data? Does that help much?
So during evaluation, I did run the same evaluations on the baseline. It's the same results. I think maybe the numbers are a bit better for the neural branchers. So obviously I wanted to focus on the data that was a bit more real.
You're saying that you, when you test on the SRC data, you get similar results.
Okay. Yeah. Same results. So better scores in the two-player game and also lower run times on the cubes.
Okay. Cool. I guess I was interested in whether training on something that looks like the Schur or Ramsey or whatever data could, like, give you a boost.
Probably. That is something that you could do with the reinforcement learning formulation. Because in that setup, the way that I trained was that I just had a pool of workers randomly sample a problem from a pool of problems. And so you could just point it at, like, the 1,000 subproblems and have them train and then test on a held out subset. I have not tried that yet, but I would expect that you would get the same results and same boost in performance.
Cool, thanks.
Josef, please.
I might have misunderstood some things, but this is a question which might also apply to Pashutan's talk, which we had before. Uh-huh. Like, why do people are so hard on yourself and use the real time? Like, whenever we were doing this, like, initial research, for example, in the Tableau setting, uh-huh. we knew that the machine learners are slow, and we that whether they really help the search. So we always use the abstract time as an evaluation metric, and only when we saw, like in the case of Nikop, like back in 2011, that we can get like a 20 times speed up in the abstract time, we sort of got interested in plugging in fast machine learners and doing things properly in real time, but the very useful information is how much speed up this gives you in the number of inferences that's
different. Right. So let me mention two things in response. So let's go back to this really simple. Oh, oops. So if we go back to this slide here, right? So, I mean, one thing that I didn't mention, but maybe I should have, is that this formulation works. So if you just code up, you know, like a DPL solver in Python, as I think some people have done, and you just plug in your network to choose the next variable always. So it's going to work, but just for small problems. And if you do it more carefully, you can make it work for even larger problems. Maybe in a logic which is more expressive and more compact, like QBF solving. So again, make sure to go see Marcus's talk up next. It's a great paper. This works. And so now the interesting challenge is, how do you make it work at scale? I just want to mention that in this work, I do show that, so in addition to the wall clock time, which for some reason the people who review your papers seem to care a lot about, I do show that this also increases the efficiency of the inference of the solver in terms of the number of choices it makes and in terms of a bunch of other proxy metrics which measure the quality of how you're branching.
And it also this may be a naive question, but why do you define all these proxy metrics? Like, why wouldn't you use just the lengths of the proof search as your ultimate metric that you want to optimize?
Well, so I mean, that kind of is what we're trying to optimize. So in the sense that, like, that is what the feedback is for the network during training.
So it seems to me like for example, in first order or high order theorem proving, the first thing, like the fact that you get a very short proof, which seemed to be the first thing you were mentioning,
right,
might be very unrelated to the lengths of the proof. So it's like we have, for example, with the hint strategy, which Bob Beroff is using, we sometimes get very long sort of guided proofs, and we can get a much shorter proof when we throw a totally different vampire strategy at it. But it may take a horrible amount of time for a vampire to find the proof, even though the sort of final proof is much shorter. So I would be sort of hesitant to use the lengths. Like I understand that it's a heuristic, but I would go for the lengths of the proof search rather than for the lengths of the final proof. But if I could choose,
right. So I mean, ultimately, the goal is to produce short proofs. So in fact, in SAT solving, it's correlated with how long the solver runs. So I think you're sort of echoing the main idea behind training on DRAT proofs.
Okay.
Right. So, namely, that like you want to prioritize the variables which show up frequently, and that will then allow the solver to guide itself into parts of the search space will be more likely to prove things in a short amount of time. So in fact, that's something that you can do in this formulation of SAT solving as an MDP as well, right? So I mean, you can assign like a small negative signal at each time step in order to penalize your network for making choices which cause the solver to run too long. And then that becomes part of the signal that your network trains on.
Can I do one more?
Sure. And feel free to go on into your previous question, because I feel like I might not have answered it.
Yeah, but I think I would just make a comment on what Joseph is saying. So I think the SAT community, well, someone who's representing the SAT community here,
sure.
SAT community is really bent on this fast SAT solver. So it's very easy to get a paper rejected at SAT for not being fast, even though they're interesting ideas. So I think you probably should apply pressure to us that we are not so bend on this this performance, but maybe what Joseph is saying, that like if the proofs are short, it already is a value on its own. That's interesting. I would just have a quick question. I maybe already said, but I missed something. So you train on the synthetic data, but in the paper you don't really describe the improvements that you're getting on let's say SAT competition benchmarks, or did I just miss that?
So there are two separate experiments. So I mean, there are actually two separate papers. So the paper here is the one that I submitted for this conference.
Yeah, I know there are two different papers. I know that. So yeah, I'm talking now about the Cupid Cooker. So I know that the glue thing.
Oh.
But now I'm talking about the Cupid Cooker.
Right. So for the Keep and Conquer experiments, we only performed these evaluations on these problems. We didn't try Keep and Conquer on SATCOMP.
And so what was the result really? I know that this was like an extended abstract, so it's hard to kind of cram all the results in, but like, can you somehow summarize what was the result on these families?
So there were two ways of evaluating. So the first was the average wall clock runtimes on the two leaves. If you just pick the variable that your network thinks is the most likely to occur in a DRAT proof and just branch.
So sorry to interrupt. So these are very small runtimes. I got very confused by this. This is not like, I mean, if
it's in hours, maybe.
No, it says seconds. So I mean, this
these are seconds.
All solving time for the whole problem, so these problems are really just very small.
Yeah. So we chose to make the problem small for the sake of being able to run the experiments at home.
Okay, so you never tried actually on some, you know, like some, well, obviously you can't run it on Marais problems because he has a cluster of, he's using hundreds of CPU a year.
Right, so I didn't have a cluster at the time, but, so I mean, maybe this might appease Yosef. So I mean, later I did show that, that the wall clock time, which might not be too convincing because the times are so small, so that difference in the wall clock times is so it's also being represented in terms of how efficient we're doing inference. So we also show that the heuristics that we learned are more conflict efficient.
Okay, so I think we're in our coffee break. So thank you again. This was a very interesting talk. See you all.